Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of A Cast to the Past. And in this exciting edition of the podcast, we'll be talking about WrestleMania 14, because in this incredible journey through the 80s, 90s, the 2000s, we talk about video games, movies, TV shows. It is a retrospective into the things that we loved and hated as we grew up. And with this episode, because we're going to be talking about WrestleMania 14, we are in many ways getting to the dawn of the Attitude Era. And we know that we are a podcast that traditionally, up until this point, has not actually covered a wrestling thing, but anybody that knows us from before knows that we are passionate and love professional wrestling. So for this episode, we're going to make sure that we are as open and broad as possible. So even if you are somebody that's not necessarily a fan of professional wrestling, but you've always been curious about it, you've always heard about them, Stone Cold Steve Austin, these The Rocks, who is this Undertaker and Kane, and why is somebody set on fire? We're going to be making sure to fill in the gaps. So if you get the network or if you go to YouTube, you have better context about what we will be talking about. And speaking of we, my name is Juan Villas. I am from Puerto Rico. Joining me as always, we have Ryan McNulty from Boston, Mass.
Hello, hello.
Keith Poschick from London, Ontario. Guys,
hi.
This is the comfort zone, because in the previous episode, we talked about 1999's Matrix. And what are your quick thoughts about that? Because Keith, you did not like going back memory lane and checking that movie out.
That's not fair. It's not that I didn't like it. There's just parts of it that didn't hold up and I thought were very lame. The Matrix is a good movie. It deserves its place on the pantheon of film, but maybe just the action scenes of the Matrix deserve to be there.
Okay, okay. So, Ryan, did you feel good about it? Did you feel happy?
I did. I was long overdue for rewatching that movie anyway, so it was nice to go back, watch it, and as Keith said, there's a few things that didn't really hold up, but I think for the most part, that's still a very good movie.
I agree. And we have a lot of episodes up until this point. We talk about The Legend of Zelda, A Link to the Past in the very first one. We talk about 90s trends, favorite Super Nintendo games, and a ton more that you can check out on both the YouTube channel and podcast apps. All of the above, including social media, are simply A Cast to the Past. Now, getting to this, Mr. McNulty, what say you about WrestleMania 14?
So, WrestleMania 14 in the year 1998 are considered by many to be the beginning of the Attitude Era, which was an extremely popular time for then called the WWF. So, thanks to the heated rivalry between Stone Cold Steve Austin and Vince McMahon, Shawn Michaels, Triple H, and China being part of the popular D-Generation X faction, and the battle between the Brothers of Destruction, Kane, and The Undertaker, WrestleMania 14 also featured rising star The Rock and former Rocky Maivia fame,
yeah.
And the controversial Goldust character. The Legion of Doom also made a return in the show with an updated look and rebranded themselves as LOD 2000. So not everything was perfect, but we're also treated to things like the light heavyweight championship match, the tag team match, European and intercontinental championship matches, which showed this era was packed with plenty of gold.
Championships all over the place. Because when I first saw this, yeah, I was so surprised. I always forget the light heavyweight championship exists, which, for those that don't know, as the title implies, these are smaller wrestlers. We would later really know about this as the cruiserweight division in many ways. But Keith, you're somebody that actually watched WrestleMania 14 back in the day, right? As opposed to Ryan and me, because I was a WCW guy. Ryan didn't start watching until like the 2000s, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I was watching. I wasn't saying yes for you, Ryan.
Ryan, speak for yourself.
You're right, yes. Anyway, so.
But yeah, I started watching wrestling, I think it was 95, and kind of haven't stopped since. So I lived through the entire Attitude Era, the lead up to it, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And yeah, I saw this live, and it's crazy to think about just how wrestling was back then compared to now.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I became a wrestling fan around October of 2000, so I was a little late to this one. The interesting thing, though, is I was very familiar with wrestling in a lot of ways just because it was so popular during this time. Wrestling was very much embedded in pop culture during the late 90s. So I was familiar with it. One of my best friends really liked wrestling. And this WrestleMania actually happened in Boston near where I live. Yet somehow I didn't find out till many years later that this WrestleMania actually happened in Boston. Somehow that all passed me by. Like I didn't even realize it. But like having gone back and seen this event, I actually did see some of these matches when I was younger. I remember my friend actually showing me a couple of these matches. So I probably saw a little bit of this show around 2000.
Okay, that's not too bad. In my case, I honestly don't, like having watched it now, I used to watch only WCW. The only time I would ever watch WWF back in the day were through VHS tapes, because we didn't have any access to any WWE or then WWF programming here in Puerto Rico, at least that, you know, we had back home. I don't know if it was due to lack of cable or something, but regardless, going back now, I do have my thoughts about when you talk about WWE or wrestling pay-per-views. People always say, oh, this one didn't feel like a pay-per-view. It felt like a normal episode of Raw or SmackDown, which are the week-to-week shows that WWE still has to this day. And I'm looking forward to our conversation about that, because I think I maybe am, slight spoiler, leaning towards that more so than the pay-per-view feel. But it's very important that we contextualize this by thinking of the fact that this came out in 1998. This is the 14th WrestleMania, as Ryan mentioned. This is embedded into pop culture. The main event of the show is Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Shawn Michaels. And the special guest enforcer is Iron Mike Tyson. So WWE had to be doing something right at this time to get somebody like Iron Mike Tyson, right? Because it's a big deal.
That is a real big deal.
This was a time when Mike Tyson was a huge household name. He was killing it. I don't know much about boxing, but he was apparently crushing it in the boxing world at this time. But everybody knew who Mike Tyson was. So the fact that they got a very relevant celebrity to be a major part of this event was huge.
So before we actually talk about the show, as we have a tradition, and I love this part, once again, context, Ryan, what are some of the movies that came out in 1998?
So for movies, we had a classic Adam Sandler movie. The 90s are not without a classic Adam Sandler movie, and that would be The Wedding Singer, one of my personal favorite Adam Sandler movies.
Yeah, I'm going to pretend like I've seen that movie.
Oh, okay, keep going, Ryan.
Yeah, let's go. All right, so the first Blade movie came out in 1998. Which that's a series I've only seen bits and pieces of, so I'll have to change that someday. Another fantastic movie, which I actually have watched recently, The Truman Show. Very, very good movie.
So damn good.
So much of it.
It's an incredible movie.
So much of it still speaks to like the world today. So that is an amazing movie. The first Rush Hour came out in this year.
Yes. I love me those movies, man. Shame about the third one. I watched it recently. It's not bad, but first two.
Did we get news of a fourth one coming out soon, though?
I had heard things about that. I know we have a Bad Boys 3 coming out. That they did confirm, but I don't know about Rush Hour 4. Although they've hinted at it. So I'll just say yes.
Fingers crossed.
Because, yeah.
Probably.
Everything's getting a sequel.
Yeah, seriously. And then one we talked about in pretty recently, Armageddon. The classic movie where it's better to train oil drillers to be astronauts than astronauts to be oil drillers.
Yes, the age-old problem.
Yep.
Apparently, though, I was reading about that, and Ben Affleck asked Michael Bay, who's the director of this movie, by the way. So there you go. This is where Michael Bay was really cutting his teeth. So Ben Affleck apparently asked him that question, and Michael Bay told him to F off. So there you go.
Really? Wow. Okay.
Don't question Michael Bay, apparently.
Yeah, don't question him. Don't question him. So Keith, I'm going to bring it to you for this part. What are some of the games that came out in 1998?
Well, you have greats like Banjo-Kazooie, that I assume is great because I never played it. I'm sure that'll be an episode one day.
Yeah.
The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, definitely a great. We had Resident Evil 2, WWF Warzone, and Spyro the Dragon. All great games coming up in that era. 1998 really was a great time for video games.
It really was. And talking about that WWF Warzone game, I actually rented that game, and I had it for like 4 months because, no, I added to, but close enough. I'll I had Attitude and Warzone. Those two games sort of had the same or similar engine. Those were made by Acclaim, I believe they were made, right, Ryan? And mm-hmm. I rented Warzone once for the N64. We had Hurricane George happen, and the rental places were closed for months. So I just had Attitude. I never bought it up until recently again, because I just had it for like 4 months. So and the best thing is, because they were closed, they didn't charge me a late fee. So I'm like, hey,
oh, nice.
I bought this game for like $4, played it for a couple of months. Looking back, though, the whole fact that, like, if nobody played these games, imagine Mortal Kombat but wrestling, because for every wrestling move, you had to have a key combination, like your Street
and
Fighters.
And they were long. You would do like up, down, left, right, up, down, left, right, B, A, just to do a choke slam.
Yeah, they treated them way too much like traditional fighting games. Warzone, I never owned, but I remember I had the PS1 demo disc that had a bunch of games on it, including Spyro the Dragon and Warzone. And I always just had to play Shawn Michaels versus Stone Cold over and over again on the demo disc.
Which isn't a bad match.
Was it Warzone or Attitude that has the famous line of just some lady yelling in the crowd, kick his ass, man!
I think it was Warzone.
Oh, it's the best thing to ever happen in a wrestling game.
It wasn't like Shane McMahon on commentary in Warzone or something?
Yeah.
Good Why?
Times. I don't know. I don't know.
He was on Heat. He was a commentator on Heat.
JR didn't want to work extra days. I don't know.
Exactly. Video game money just wasn't worth it.
Yeah, I guess so. And Keith, like, when talking about wrestling in 97, 98, especially, you know, when it comes to WWF, did it feel for you as a wrestling fan like it was the hot period? As we're saying, you know, as I mentioned earlier, looking back, we see this as the dawn of the Attitude Era. Back in the day, that wasn't a thing because we weren't sure what was going to happen. When you look at this pay-per-view, when we get to talking about The Rock, we're not witnessing prime era Rock, but we're seeing like this transition. You know, he is definitely this guy that talks to himself in third person. You know, we were seeing Stone Cold, you know, Mr. McMahon versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, a lot of great stuff. As a kid watching it back in the day, did it feel like that thing that everybody talks about now is the golden period of professional wrestling?
As we got closer to WrestleMania 14, absolutely. But I think more the thing that's more important, especially leading up to WrestleMania 14, is just how important the 1997-1998 year from WrestleMania to WrestleMania is important to the WWF. Just like so much changed in that year time. And by year, I'm talking March to March, WrestleMania to WrestleMania. In the way that, like, between those two shows, you had that huge rocket strapped to Stone Cold Steve Austin. The main guy of this show didn't really get, he was a rising star, but after that WrestleMania 13 match with Bret Hart, that's when his stock just shot through the roof. That's when you knew that Stone Cold Steve Austin was going to be a big deal. You had that go on in that year. You had the Hart Foundation go on in that year. You had the events that inevitably led to the Montreal Screwjob happen in that year. Everything that happened between Bret the Hitman Hart and Shawn Michaels, that happened at the same time that Austin's stock was rising up. Leading up until this WrestleMania, you had Stone Cold Steve Austin, who was hotter than hell, break his neck at SummerSlam. So people weren't even sure if Stone Cold Steve Austin would make it to this event, but he came back early from an extremely severe neck injury just to do that. You had all of that happening at the same time. Then you had Shawn Michaels. He had a very unfortunate injury that put him out leading into January. Like, he was going into this match with a broken back, and just all of that stuff happening in a short period of time, combined with the fact that all of the momentum that the WWF was gaining with the birth of the Attitude Era post Montreal Screwjob. Like, it really is, at least in my opinion, one of the most important years in WWF history. And it all, like, culminated at WrestleMania 14.
And something that everybody, whether you're a wrestling fan or not, you've seen something that happened this year. When we talk about King of the Ring. There's a famous match between The Undertaker and Mankind, the infamous Hell in a Cell spot. The match starts, both men are up there. The Undertaker throws Mankind off the steel structure. So this year was absolutely packed. It had the Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Mr. McMahon rivalry. Just great stuff. But as you mentioned, and like I'd always find that fascinating, especially looking at this show, because we are witnessing technically the end of Shawn Michaels' career, which is funny saying now because he retired, but then he just unretired recently. But you know what I mean, because he was gone from the company at a wrestling capacity by the end of the year, right? Or this is around the time that started happening because of those injuries you mentioned.
Well, this was his last match. This is a guy that was the top guy in the business and was a real pain to work with, apparently. This was the end of that career. You had Steve Austin going up and Shawn Michaels going down, and it just, they collided at WrestleMania.
Yeah, and the other part is that, you know, the main event and the overarching thing, we have Triple H on the show, we have China. So this is like the end of stage one of D-Generation X, because later, you know, you would get the reformed DX, you would have Six-Pac transition from WCW. He was a guy that used to be called the 1-2-3 kid in wrestling in WWF, and then he would transition. So just insane, just so much stuff happening. So
yeah, that's something I didn't even mention. The formation of D-Generation X happened in that 97-98 year. Something that, you know, DX became what it became, but the fact or what it did at that time is ridiculous.
So Ryan, what surprised you as somebody that started watching wrestling in the 2000s, but I'm assuming you always heard about this, especially now that people have access to the network, to so many ways of watching this. Is there anything that piqued you like, yes, I'm watching this and I completely understand the significance, or did you feel kind of neutral about it?
I definitely understood the significance to the major matches, you know, the top two matches, the Shawn Michaels and Austin and the Undertaker versus Kane, because I've heard so much about those feuds. They're very much like legendary feuds that are still talked about to this day. One thing that right off the bat did surprise me was, you know, like I said, I started watching wrestling in 2000, just how different the roster is within a 2-year span to like when I started watching.
It's crazy.
Sure, there's still a good amount of people that are in the show that are still there when I started watching, but there's a ton of people that I more associate with, like a lot of the teams that were in the first, that opening match that we'll get to, a lot of those teams are just completely gone by the time I started watching wrestling.
That's just crazy to look at. So you mentioned the card. Let's actually just briefly go over the card, and then we'll be doing, it's interesting, right? We are reviewing in a retrospective way each match. So we'll talk about, you know, how we felt about each thing, you know, how we thought about the buildup of that wrestler. I think a key part of this is that people always say so many great things about WWE video packages, and I think those always help when you go back. I've watched, you know, WrestleMania 20 through 30, you know, within the past couple of years. And those video packages, if you forgot a story, they do a pretty decent job, right, of sort of catching you up. So it's interesting to go into this one and seeing how good a job they did to sort of give you that context as somebody that's going back. But yeah, some of the matches, we started it off with a 15 tag team battle royal, with the winning team getting a chance at a future championship opportunity. A light heavyweight title match between Taka Michinoku, the champion, versus Aguila. A WWF European title match, Triple H with China taking on Owen Hart. A mixed tag match, Luna and the artist formerly known as Goldust taking on Mark Mero and
or
Sable.
Or how you have Tafka Goldust.
Yeah, the Tafka Goldust. The WWF Intercontinental title match, The Rock, accompanied by D'Lo Brown, Kama Mustafa, which many may know as Papa Shango or The Godfather, and Mark Henry Company versus Ken Shamrock, which, Keith, you've actually recently spoken to Ken Shamrock, right?
Yeah, I did a full like Comic-Con panel with Ken Shamrock. It was a lot of fun. Very nice guy in real life.
How was that experience? I mean, hey, it's not every day that you can talk about a show going back and you've actually had interactions with these people.
Yeah, terrifying it was being on stage with a man that can snap my neck in five different ways before I could blink, and then being on stage in front of like 100 people. But, you know, Ken, I can't say enough great things about it, made it as easy as possible. He's a great talker, loves talking about the business, his personal story. Actually had a lot of fun with it. I'll make sure to make sure that people out there can check that out.
Yeah, link it up on the Twitter or wherever you can. Yeah, same here. So we also had a WWF World Tag Team Title Dumpster Rules match. It is the Attitude Era, folks. Things, just things. The New Age Outlaws, which are Billy Gunn, bro, and the Road Dogg, taking on Cactus Jack and Chainsaw Charlie, also known as Terry Funk. We also had the highly anticipated match, Kane, the brother of The Undertaker, being accompanied by Paul Bearer, taking on said Taker. And then the main event, which was the WWF World Heavyweight Championship match, Shawn Michaels, accompanied by China and Triple H, taking on Stone Cold Steve Austin. But most importantly, the secondary main event of this was that, as we mentioned earlier, Iron Mike Tyson was the special guest enforcer for this match, which I always found fascinating, but we'll get to that when we get to that. So I think it is awesome that we started the show with a 15 tag team battle royal, because as Ryan mentioned, you know, you want to know what the roster was like at the time. There's a guy that we now know as John Bradshaw Layfield, or JBL. And I kept hearing the announcers refer to the fact that he was in this match. All of a sudden, I see this huge handlebar mustache, and I'm like, what is that? Who thought that was a good idea? Can somebody blur that? Can that be shown on screen? What did you guys think about this?
Majestic mustache.
This was a cluster.
Oh god, that's the only way to describe this match. So it was, the rules are, it's 15 tag teams. If your partner gets eliminated, you have to leave the ring and go to the back. Well, that maybe happened only like three or four times out of the 15 teams. It was a nightmare of a match. Just it was impossible to follow. It's interesting that there was only two entrances for the match. You only got to see the Nation of Domination and the newly returned Legion of Doom 2000 with their little motorcycle helmets. And that was a bad thing.
I know Animal was there. Was that Hawk or was that?
That was Hawk.
Okay.
Draws didn't come until later. But okay.
See, I wasn't sure about that because I knew that there was like another version of LOD. But yeah, this match to me was like, I don't think anything was too memorable. I was just kind of observing like how quickly things changed and how I didn't really remember pretty much any of these teams. Like Midnight Express is a team I never really knew too much about. I've always heard about
them. You mean you didn't know Bombastic Bob Holly? That wasn't something that stuck with you?
And not exactly. So I was just like, wow, this is just a lot of teams that I didn't really watch much of.
Yeah, I mean, you had Too Hot, which are Scott Taylor and Brian Christopher, also known as Scotty Too Hotty, for example.
Oh my god, Kane wouldn't shut up about Brian Christopher the whole night. It's like, we get it. He's your son. We get it.
You also had the Headbangers, the Godwins, the Rock and Roll, Ed the Midnight Expresses. Like, it was such a clash because so many of these were the characters that wrestlers would make fun of, you know, like the Godwins. I just wrote in my notes here, it was busy but no substance. Like, I kept watching this and I'm like, I know there's a lot going on screen, but it's a lot of nothing. Like, can this please end?
100%, 100%. Mm-hmm.
It says a ton when the commentators can barely follow along. Like, oh, that's Mark Henry. He's not even supposed to be in the damn match. Chains is eliminated. Why is his partner still in there? That's my Jim Ross, by the way. But
it makes me appreciate that in modern wrestling today, if there was a similar match, that there are kind of set pieces that are going to kind of happen, that they sort of have these planned spots where all of a sudden you'll see some big bump in the middle of the ring that you're going to be like, oh, whoa, that was cool. So you'll actually remember something, where this is just a cluster and you can't make heads or tails of anything that's going on.
Exactly.
And neither can most of the wrestlers.
Yeah.
Very true. Now, to put a nice little bow on these matches as we speak about it, I went back and looked at the Wrestling Observer ratings for these matches that I'll kind of say as we go along. If you don't know the Wrestling Observer, that's wrestling critic extraordinaire Dave Meltzer. He's been around since the beginning of wrestling, as far as I'm concerned, and is kind of like the voice of critiques in wrestling. And the Observer, I will say, gave this 15-team battle royal to determine the number one contender to a WWF Tag Championship -1.5 stars, which I think it's aptly deserved.
Yeah.
That's one thing. Sorry to interrupt you. That is one thing I wanted to point out before I forgot. And rightly, I think it deserves that rating. But I did find it very interesting for a WrestleMania that there was like a number one contender match, because typically today, for WrestleMania, it's kind of looked at as the very much like the finality. Like, this is the Super Bowl. This is like the end of the season. And I felt like this show, there was surprisingly a lot of like looking forward, like, oh, here's what we're doing after WrestleMania. Like, they're already thinking about it, which I feel like you don't really see as much today.
Yeah, yeah, that is a very good point. And it's just weird how you start the show with, hey, they're wrestling for a future thing. Like, if it was like time to like the third match of the night, then maybe, but you're opening it by talking about a future opportunity.
Like,
okay.
Normally, if that happened, it would be like later that night. Like, LOD would get that title shot later that night.
Which LOD won, which is no surprise. As you guys mentioned, we only had two entrances, so... Gee, I wonder if it's going to be the Nation of Domination, which is kind of spiraling out of control, or the newly returning Legion of Doom 2000 with Sonny. So they won, and depending on the reception for this episode, if you guys want us to talk about more professional wrestling down the line, we can sort of see what happened later. After this, we retreated to a DX public workout video, which I felt very old looking at. And I think throughout the show, you get these little tidbits. We're going to get to an interview that just had me so confused. And Keith sort of shed some light. And this is why Keith is the wrestling master of this.
Indeed.
And then the next match that we had.
Well, before you go on there to bring up the DX public workout for a bit, like, that's a bit of a like a historic moment as well. Talking about how Shawn Michaels, like I mentioned earlier, that Shawn Michaels was becoming unbearable to work with. That public workout almost didn't happen or got canceled midway through. They make no mention of it on the actual WrestleMania show, but there was an incident where like something got thrown. I can't remember exactly what it was, like a battery or something, at Shawn Michaels when he was in the ring, and he stormed out of that public workout, and they basically needed to pause it for like a half an hour and go into the limo and try to get Shawn Michaels to come back out. And like finish the actual event, like that scene that they showed at the end of like Shawn Michaels and Mike Tyson kissing a Stone Cold Steve Austin tied up in the ropes. If you don't have the context, boy, that's a weird sentence.
It's a BDSM, man.
Even but watching that, it was weird.
Yeah, that almost didn't happen because of a temper tantrum by Shawn Michaels.
Added to era, folks. Temper tantrums are all over the place. And this takes us to this light heavyweight championship match with Taka Michinoku, who a lot of wrestling fans know is a caricature in WWE with the Kai and Tai tag team with Funaki. He was a champion at this point, taking on Aguila. And I think that this match was fascinating to watch because whether you're a current wrestling fan or not, you can't help but acknowledge that wrestling has become far more athletic now. I'd say more so than the stories it's been about, the athletic maneuvers. And people talk about this as a post-2000 thing. But you look at this match, and this match seems almost like a... like they're trying to like mock current wrestling in many ways, because every single second of this match was, what can I do off the top rope? It felt like I was playing a wrestling game. Hey, you know what? I'm just going to get to the top rope and hopefully I'll press X and I will fall on you and I can get the win. What did you guys think about this? Because I have some thoughts about it.
I never even knew this Aguila guy existed, and I've been a wrestling fan for like 18 years. I've never heard of this guy in my life. I don't know how I missed it.
And he
it.
Was at WrestleMania.
Yeah, this guy had a match at WrestleMania. I've never heard of him.
But I think an important note is he didn't get an entrance at WrestleMania. Just a match in a title match at WrestleMania.
I can't believe I felt like they didn't do jobber entrances too much when I first started watching. Apparently, I was way wrong because they're doing jobber entrances at WrestleMania.
If you count the Battle Royal so far in the show, there have been 13 jobber entrances.
Yeah. As for the actual match itself, I didn't think it was anything particularly special. It really just felt like, let's string a bunch of spots together. I didn't feel like there was any type of story being told to me. It was just like, oh, let's do this, let's do that, let's do that. Boom, it's done. Not very memorable.
I have to agree. It felt more like a stunt show than an actual wrestling match where, okay, I'm going to do a flip. Now you're going to do a drop kick. Now I'm going to do another flip. And I guess we're going to go home because we're done doing our flips. And yeah, because of that, there is no real chemistry in it. And if you want to know what a dead crowd sounds like, just watch that match. I don't think the crowd could be any less invested in what they were seeing. It's what the light heavyweight cruiserweight style kind of gets a bad rap for. This is a great example of it. And it's more of like a stunt show than it is a wrestling match. And it was really on display here, which is why it only got half a star.
I can think see why.
That's about fair.
Yeah. And I enjoy me some cruiserweight action. And I legitimately dislike this match. I was upset watching this match because it felt like they, and this is probably what happened. We've heard enough interviews. Every wrestler has a podcast now, and every wrestler talks about this era. It's kind of like, well, they kind of just gave us time, and we kind of did our thing. It felt like somebody told them, I forget how long this match was, but hypothetically, hey, you have 8 minutes. Okay, what can we do in 8 minutes? Like, forget about selling, which for those who know, selling means like, you know, acting like it is painful, like it is actually hurting. That's what the storytelling element that Ryan was talking about. It was just move after move after move after diving spot after diving spot.
If you
want to
see the weakest kicks in wrestling, look at Abula in that match.
So bad. And you would hear so many wrestlers complain about cruiserweight action and about how it didn't tell a story. And for me, it was always weird to hear because I would see WCW cruiserweights, which I'm not saying every match in WCW was perfect, but you had your Rey Mysterios, Dean Malenko, Eddie Guerrero. You had some really good stuff. And then you watch this. And I'm not knocking against Taka Michinoku, but I haven't watched a ton, but I know he's like a legendary guy. He's done a lot of great stuff. WWE maybe misused him. This match is in no way an excellent showcase for cruiserweight action. Super forgettable. And yeah. The fact that Aguila didn't get an entrance says everything you need to know about this match.
Pretty much.
So up next, oh boy, we don't have a match. We have a segment. And what a segment it is. It is an interview towards The Rock. And I feel like I cannot do this justice. So Keith, I'm just going to leave this to you, man. You present it. You do whatever you want with this.
First, I have a question for you two, because I'm assuming that you guys are seeing this out of context.
Yep.
What did you think was going on during this?
I don't know how vulgar I can be, but I mean, sexual references bonanza, if I can
like,
say.
Why do you think The Rock was saying those things? And why do you think he was being asked about if he was president, he would do this?
So we know the Monica Lewinsky thing happened around this time, right? I don't know your
it's
politics.
1998.
But... Yeah.
Okay, so is that because, like, is that the reason why, or?
Close enough. Yeah.
For me, it pretty much like what Juan said, like, I thought this woman, I was like, okay, is she like a celebrity guest or something, or is she just the normal interview girl? Because I don't know who that person is in 1998. But I assumed just because the whole Bill Clinton scandal with Monica Lewinsky was such a huge thing that happened and everyone was talking about it, I just assumed they're like, oh, let's be topical and interview The Rock about being presidential.
Mm-hmm. Well, it goes a layer deeper than that, where the person that was interviewing him was Jennifer Flowers, who had a 12-year relationship with Bill Clinton that she admitted to previously. So it was like a thing of like, oh, okay, we've got the Monica Lewinsky thing's hot. Let's get Jennifer Flowers in here, make jokes about Bill Clinton, which they, boy, did they go to that well multiple times that night during the Sable match. During this, where they had like, oh, if The Rock becomes president, he's going to make a bunch of dick jokes and he doesn't care about the homeless. And they
I wrote a thing. I wrote a thing. According to The Rock, he is a nine out of 10 times, he'd be a hung jury.
which you wouldn't get anything done. It doesn't even make any sense. No justice would be served.
I forgot about that. Oh my god.
When you said that, I heard that. This is what I actually did. I paused the pay-per-view on the network and I walked for a little bit. I'm like, this is painful. Ryan, you have a favorite word that starts with a C and it is cringe. This was the definition of cringe.
I thought you were going somewhere else with this C word, but I'll just say this. The hilarious thing is, it's not even that far out of the realm to think that The Rock may actually run for president at some point in time now.
Yeah. Right? Like, I just he's hope they teased replay about
this.
It.
I just
he's
hope they teased replay about it. This.
Yeah, I hope that this comes back up when The Rock, if he does run for president. Like, oh, this is your stance, hey, Rock? But it's so crazy to think about, like, this is the same guy that is like the nicest person in the world these days. And he was saying stuff like that.
I hate the homeless. I'd be a hung jury. In 2020, Rock, would you continue to consider yourself a hung jury? Oh, man. I don't know what to say about this. Any thoughts about this before we move on? It's just bad.
Yeah, it's just bad. You know what? I think that's what it comes down
it's
to.
It's kind of funny, at least.
Oh, man, never forget. So with that, we go to the European title match, which is Triple H with the DX band. They played an instrumental version of the DX song, which I thought was, it's actually a nice attention to detail because later on we had a similar entrance with Shawn Michaels and that one had lyrics. So it's kind of like the evolution. Triple H wasn't good enough for words, just for the instruments.
Yeah, he's the low guy.
Yeah, so... China was handcuffed to Sergeant Slaughter. I thought that the combination of the commentary of that interaction, obviously, and I feel like we need to mention this, China and Triple H were allegedly in a relationship around this point in real life. You know, WWE would basically blacklist her for many years because of many situations. China passed away, it was about a year ago, 2 years ago, more or less. And then afterwards is when they finally reference her. But before that, I mean, she practically never existed, according to the WWE. So it's fascinating to watch this match, knowing how things unfolded years after. What did you guys think about Owen Hart, Triple H? Two very talented individuals. Owen Hart, you know, people have nothing but great things to say about him from an entertainment in-ring standpoint. Did this live up to the European title standards?
I honestly think that it was the first good match on the show. Just how you got to see two people that were just really good at their craft. And even though Triple H was still on the up at this point, he hadn't hit his peak. You could see the makings of just like a top superstar there. And then Owen Hart is one of the greatest in-ring technicians of all time. So you just got to see two solid workers go at it in a great match. And there was a little bit of shenanigans involved with the China Sergeant Slaughter stuff, but they didn't really focus on it all that much during the match until the finish. So you at least got a good lead up to that shenanigan filled finish. And I really enjoyed this match.
I mean, I thought it was fine. They really milked the whole handcuff thing at the beginning. Like, it really took forever.
Yeah, that took a little too long for things to
finally start going. But I feel like that was kind of just a classic Attitude Era thing where they focused more on like the character moments than the matches. The matches were almost secondary, which I think in some ways is something that is actually missing from a lot of today's wrestling. But the whole concept of handcuffing her to China to Sergeant Slaughter is like the dumbest concept ever. As if, like, you know, wouldn't it be better to like I don't know, handcuff her to like a post up at the top of the stage or something. Like, you're just asking like for her to interfere. And I know that's the point, but just the logic behind it, it really was very stupid, because immediately you're just like, oh, China's handcuffed to Sergeant Slaughter. Ryan, yeah, Ryan, that'll work.
We've talked about this and yeah. like that. You just said logic and wrestling in the same sentence.
Yeah.
Stop that.
I'm sorry, man. Work. There's only so much disbelief I can suspend, you know. There's only so much. As far as the rest of the match, I thought it was fine. Like, it wasn't anything that was like, oh my god, like that was a barn burner. It was just fine. And then of course you kind of had your screwy finish, classic to the Attitude Era.
I kind of agree with Keith. I thought that this is the first real match of the show. The only one that I felt like they said, let's give them something to sort of remember. But even then, comparing it to nowadays, this felt like a modern weekly television program match, in that it's two really talented guys sort of doing a match. We had the screwy finish with the powder to the face and then the low blow. Then we got the pedigree. I love how at the end, for no reason, China just beats Sergeant Slaughter down. It's like, you already powdered him in the face. Like, come on, give the guy some slack. He's an old dude, you know? But I didn't think much of it. And sadly, I think like that's sort of how I felt with most of this show, which I think we'll be talking about this at the end. But people always say, oh, this WrestleMania wasn't as good as last year's WrestleMania. And they almost say that, you know, each year. But looking at this, yes, I can feel that this is the dawn of the Attitude Era, or the beginning, or whatever, but the beginning was a little rocky. Let's just say that.
It was. And before we move on, I'll just say that Dave Meltzer enjoyed this match and gave it 3 stars.
Wow, 3. Okay.
Yeah. I don't think the Dave Meltzer of today would give it 3 stars.
Yeah, definitely not 6 either, so. Let's get to the mixed tag match. And this one was actually the first match I enjoyed on the show, fascinatingly enough. So it's Mark Mero and Sable taking on Luna Vachon. I love saying that. Vachon, it's just a fun name. And Goldust. And I forget, first of all, Goldust is still wrestling in 2018 and looks better now.
Crazy.
Yeah.
What?
Way better.
Yeah. It's not even
funny.
It's that
DDP yoga. DDPY, yeah, baby.
It ain't your mama's yoga. So what you guys think about this? Because this was, it's fascinating to see how controversial he was, because obviously there was a lot of sexual innuendo, references, clothing, outfits. You know, this is the son of Dusty Rhodes. Just so many things to think about, you know, this iteration of Goldust. And then you pair that up with Mark Mero and Sable, which I love how even the entire storyline is very true to life, where it's, hey, Mark Mero is here, but everybody really cares about Sable, and that's how it actually was. So that's weird that they made that a little bit too real, if you ask me. What'd you think about this combination, the fascination with Sable? This is supposed to be like her first real showcase of a match, and even though it was very limited, she did the TKO way better than Mark Mero could.
Sad, but true.
Yeah.
Yeah, for me, I was like, my instant reaction when I, like, after seeing this match is, holy crap, Sable is over as hell. Like, damn, like, that was the real pop of the night. Like, that first, like, big crowd reaction was Sable. Like, everyone else before this, it was like, the crowd did not care. The second Sable was out there, it was like, damn, all of a sudden, like, the crowd, like, awoken from their slumber and are actually reacting to things. So that was, like, the huge standout thing, just realizing how, like, over with the crowd that Sable was. I don't have any context to Goldust during this time, so I was like, what in the blue hell is that outfit? I have no idea what I'm looking at.
Well, Silver Hill. Yeah. Silver Hill.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this match,
Blue Dust came later.
Yeah. This match was fine for what it was. Like you were saying, Juan, about the whole Mark Mero Sable thing, I knew it was a thing that everyone talked about, like Mark Mero being forgettable and it was all about Sable. I had no idea that was actually like the in storyline thing going on too.
Yeah,
but I can see why. So yeah, to me it was just all about like you said, Sable, for what she had to do, she executed it very well, did exactly what the crowd wanted to see, and it just worked. And holy crap, people really love Sable.
Yeah, I think that's the thing that stands out the most about this match is just how people loved Sable that much. It's crazy the reaction that she got. And I actually found the story of this match a bit weird thinking of, because even in the video package, they kind of allude to like, oh, okay, Mark Marrow's jealous of Sable. Mark Marrow is getting eclipsed by Sable. He's becoming jealous. He's trying to bring her down, but they're fine for this match. You know, yeah. Mark Marrow and Sable need to be on a tag team well, and work together.
He's just trying to stay relevant, man. He's hanging on.
Poor guy.
Yeah, I guess so. Fair. But yeah, you know, the match was great for what it was. It was supposed to be a showcase of Sable. They really down-talked poor Mark Marrow and Goldust in this match. Like, oh, it's the two most jealous guys on the roster. They don't really matter here. We're all here to see Sable. And Sable 100% executed what she needed to do there. It was limited, but it worked. And funny enough, Dave Meltzer gave this 3 stars as well. So the exact same rating as Triple H and Owen Hart, this mixed tag match got.
And I think going back to what Ryan said earlier about the importance of storytelling in wrestling, this match is the epitome of it, because even though it was kind of weird, as Keith mentioned, so the entire video package is about Mark Marrow sort of being jealous of Sable, but in the match they're fine, but the match had a purpose and it delivered, which is here's Sable. She's supposed to showcase her wrestling abilities. She did. And the little that she did was actually great. So everybody wins, you know, and it was a pretty enjoyable match. And then we were treated to a cameo or special appearance by J-E-double-F. J-A-double-R-E-double-T. Jeff Jarrett.
Ha ha. Ain't I great?
Ryan, you really had no exposure. Like, given your wrestling fandom, which is post-2000.
Please tell me your thoughts on Tennessee Lee.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I was just like, what is going on? This was the most pointless thing I've ever seen.
And you're not that wrong.
Jeff Jarrett did nothing. He did nothing.
He was literally just there to bring Jennifer Flowers to the ring. Yep. That's his entire purpose. And Tennessee Lee was there to hold the microphone because she couldn't read the cards and hold the microphone.
I was like,
wow,
that was just completely pointless.
Just so out of context, none of it made sense, which for Ryan, that was out of context.
Yep.
And it made no sense.
It made no sense.
So let's get to the match then that we were going to be talking about related to that, which is the WWF Intercontinental Championship match between The Rock, accompanied once again by D'Lo Brown, Kamu Mustafa, and Mark Henry versus
the Nation of Domination.
Yeah, the NOD. And to preface this, this is sort of the point where Farouk, which is the leader, he's kind of like shoved to the side by The Rock. You know, he does come out later in the match and really says, hey, I'm not really going to help you. But it is a fascinating match to watch because you're seeing The Rock at this point and he's not in his prime, right? Like, people are hating on him. They're still referencing the Die Rocky Die chants in the commentary. So just think about that. You know, Rocky Maivia is not too far back. You know what's going to happen in just a couple of months and years and decades after. And then you see Ken Shamrock, which Keith and I are big fans of this Something to Wrestle podcast, and that's a big inspiration for this episode and a lot of the wrestling discussion. And they did talk about at one point, like, Ken Shamrock should have been a big deal because I saw him in this match. First of all, he is gassed to the gills.
Oh, my God.
Realistically speaking, I mean, he looks unhuman. He looks like the Terminator wishes he could look like Ken Shamrock. But then he's also super fast. He comes from an MMA background, but he's got the pro wrestling thing down. I mean, he looked like a star. So it's kind of weird that he didn't really, you know, excel to the next level. People always say, like, maybe he lacked the enthusiasm. But, like, the whole snapping thing, he felt like a dangerous man. Dare I say, the world's dangerous man. What you guys think about this match here?
Yeah, it was a great match. The Rock was still finding his own. And I think it kind of showed there where I thought The Rock oversold things a little too much when it comes to Ken Shamrock's offense. And
I mean,
then
that's
you
The Rock
had,
in a nutshell, though.
Yeah, very true. And then you had Ken Shamrock with his somewhat limited offense, a lot of like strikes and stuff, which I guess kind of plays to Ken's strength. But it wasn't a very technical match, but it kind of fell flat for me on the story end as well, where I think it should have succeeded. And then I was not a fan of the ending at all. That whole Ken Shamrock started beating he won the match. Ken Shamrock wins and he beats everybody up. So they took away his win and his Intercontinental title. So he beats people up even more. Bit of a weird match, especially for a WrestleMania match. It fell very flat for me. And it should have been better with the caliber of a performer in the ring.
Yeah, I thought this was really dumb. It was just dumb. Like, I felt like the actual match itself was like 2.5 minutes and The Rock just tapped out within like a second. And you're just used to The Rock being like elite level. So you're like, what? The Rock is like tapping out like immediately. And then, yeah, it felt like the whole post-match brawl was actually longer than the match itself. And then, yeah, it was very much like this is a Monday Night Raw weekly television thing that we would do where
100%.
Oh, we're going to end this match really quick. Then there's a beatdown. Now we're going to reverse the decision. So it was just like not the type of thing you would want to do as like a feud ending thing or something. So once again, it felt like this whole WrestleMania just feels like any other pay-per-view because we're thinking about next month. We're still building the next month, baby. You know, that's what it felt like to me.
You could tell that maybe time was cut short because you had a lot of stuff going on, because there was the fact that The Rock, as you mentioned, Ryan, you know, this is the wrestling term of he jobbed out, you know, he lost super easily. But you also had the Farouk element, which almost made no sense for him to come out, because it's like it wasn't even a match. It was so one-sided, you know, like why would you have this extra mile of the guy coming out to try to save The Rock but not really doing it, just sort of going back? And then you have the whole thing with the referees. I felt like a lot of it felt very forced, like something was cut but everything else was kept the same, so it just didn't make a lot of sense. And it's just fascinating, The Rock in a WrestleMania match, it is very, very forgettable. But we know what happens afterwards.
Yeah, I mean, look at the leap of Rock WrestleMania matches. Yeah. You go from this match to the main event of WrestleMania 15.
Hey, but at least we had an awesome match right after this one, right?
True, but before that, we got this, or let me try that again. This match got 1.5 stars from the Wrestling Observer.
That's too much considering.
That might even be generous.
What match? Like, that's the first question. What match are you rating, you know?
That's true. Hey,
then we had ourselves a dumpster tag title match between the New Age Outlaws, Mick Foley, and Chainsaw Charlie. It's
call me crazy. I actually like this match.
Okay, no,
I don't think that's crazy at all.
I thought, you know what? You want to talk about things that were actually memorable on this show? This was like, after the whole Sable thing, this was the next thing to me that was like, hey, that was actually kind of fun and memorable. Like, some of the spots didn't really hit, like Foley kind of like just like rolling into the dumpster like lazily was like,
there was a few times in this match where I was like, Jesus, Mick Foley. And that was the first time, like, why are you doing this? Where he just kind of like throws himself into the side of a dumpster.
That's not even a spot, dude. That's not even a spot. You just like
hurting yourself.
You bubble raid. Seriously, that was, I don't know what the hell that was, but I mean, the ladder tipping in with the two people falling into the dumpster. I don't remember exactly who.
It was Mr. Ass.
And was Foley the other one, I think?
It was Cactus Jack and Mr. Ass.
Yeah.
Okay, which I feel like we need to stop this for a second and point out that that is the actual name of this individual that used to be known as Billy Gunn, Badass Billy Gunn, but for a while he was only referred to as Mr. Ass.
Yeah,
wrestling.
That's
wrestling.
It's a thing, people. I mean, which with that spot, it annoyed me because he got up like 5 seconds afterwards. He got up like it was nothing. I'm like, dude, at least like, you know, act like your back is hurting or something. That
people want to complain about selling today. Like all these old wrestlers complain about wrestlers not like showing that they're hurt enough and stuff like that. I felt like there was a severe lack of selling going on throughout this show. So, you know, a lot of hypocrisy going on. But anyway, I enjoyed this match, and I thought it was creative for them to, even though it's not satisfying for the crowd, for them to end the match backstage. It was pretty creative to be like, oh, they just found another dumpster backstage, and then they put them in that dumpster and won.
Genius.
So I thought it was fun.
Great in theory, up until the fact that nobody actually knew the match was over until like 30 seconds after. They're like going like, did we win? Tim White's like, yeah, I guess you did. And that's probably the one blemish on this match that I overall pretty enjoyed a lot. Like I mentioned, there's a few times where I just kind of saw Cactus Jack / Mick Foley and thought to myself, what the hell are you doing, man? Like, no wonder you're in bad shape. You just cannonballed yourself into the side of a dumpster. Why would you do that to yourself? But, you know, the Attitude Era was known for these car crash style matches, and this was 100% that, but it was done well, and we would see a lot of examples of done poorly in the next couple of years after it. But this, I'd say this is up there on the higher side of these car crash hardcore matches. And Dave Meltzer agreed and gave it 3.75 stars.
Not bad. Hey, not they bad. Should be proud
we seem
of that.
To be in line with Meltzer.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Which I feel like we need to go back for a second. When we talk about violence, going back to The Rock, chair shots.
Oh, my God.
Chair shots.
Oh, my God.
The video package went first. Because first, like, set the context. He, like, how is Ken Shamrock alive? So, for those who don't know, chair shots to the head were very commonplace in wrestling up until, like, mid-2000s and even towards a little bit of the late 2000s, like 2010. But with this, he didn't give him a chair shot over the head. The one in the video package was to the face.
Oh.
To the face.
And
what?
Not, he like swung for the fences with that chair shot.
Oh my God.
Yes. Back then, nobody was talking about CTE or concussions or anything. So now it's very hard to go back and watch this with that in mind, just knowing how brutal, like, and the damage that's doing to all these individuals. It's very, very hard to watch.
It's crazy, man. And now we're going to get to a very interesting match. This is Kane versus The Undertaker. So a lot of things happening in this that are very infamous. So first of all, the whole thing was that The Undertaker and Kane are actual brothers. Kane was always presumed dead. You know, he shows up in the Hell in a Cell match, and it becomes this thing of my brother is alive, but he was supposed to be burned. Oh, it's like
you
got
to say it like Paul Bear.
Kane's alive, he's alive. And then we have this whole thing where the Undertaker's, I'm not going to fight my brother. I'm not going to wrestle my brother. And it's actually a good story. It's a very good story of he keeps getting beaten down by his brother, but he refuses to wrestle him and then snaps and says, at WrestleMania. But before that, here's something very special that is constantly replayed. Pete Rose. Who's Pete Rose, people?
I'm asking you guys. He's a former baseball player that everyone, like, he basically should be in the Hall of Fame of baseball, but he was gambling or something like that. He got caught.
Didn't he get disgraced for like gambling on his own games?
Yeah,
and
there was some gambling thing, and he'll never be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. So WWE is like, well, hey, hang out here.
All you need to do is take tombstones from Kane for 3 years in a row.
This is my moment, though. This is my moment right now.
All right, I'm
because
sorry,
Pete right. Rose comes out. This is in Boston. This is my hometown. And he's trashing Boston. And he's doing a good job of getting a ton of heat from the crowd. And there was just one line that just like made me laugh, because this is 1998. All of our sports teams at this point in time pretty much sucked. And then he called Boston the city of losers, and he's making fun of the Red Sox for like not winning the World Series in like 80 years. And it's just funny to look back now, where since 2001, Boston has won like 11 world championships between all four sports. And the Red Sox literally just won the World Series again like a couple weeks ago as of this recording.
Would you say they were motivated because of Pete Rose to
Maybe. You know, because it was only a couple years later that all the momentum started. But it is just funny because the 90s were a rough time for Boston sports. And he really hit a nerve there because he talked about Billy Buckner and like picking up the tickets or whatever. So that was a famous thing where the Red Sox in, I think, 1986 were like really poised to win a World Series to finally break what they called like the curse. And this guy, Billy Buckner, in a crucial game, basically the ball went right through his legs and they didn't win. And I think they lost the next game after that. So
I just loved Pete Rose's delivery of that line where it's like, oh, I went to get his tickets, but they rolled through his legs and he couldn't pick it up. Yeah. How about it?
Yeah, how about it? just such like I just flew in from Vegas and boy, are my arms tired. Like he's got that
so
like
punchable.
Old school like comedian. Yeah.
Really good at his craft. So obviously you associate that with Kane and The Undertaker.
Yeah, clearly.
Absolutely.
So what say you guys about this match? Obviously a lot of build up. I mean, two of the greatest of all time, still active to this day. Active is a
for
relative
better, for
term.
Worse.
Yeah. For better, for worse.
So what you guys think?
This match was all story for me, where I think the lead up to it is incredible, and that's why people remember it fondly. The entire story of Undertaker versus Kane, my brother's alive, oh yes. But once we got to the actual match, it was two very large men slowly beating each other up for quite a while. And it was a very slow paced kind of methodical match that I got kind of bored in. And then it was like the birth of the finisher fest at the end of this match as well, where it took multiple tombstones to put Kane down. I didn't really click for me. And there's a reason why the story is remembered more fondly than the match.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't think the match was anything special. I mean, yeah, it had a little bit of memorable stuff like Taker diving over and going through the Spanish announce table, but it didn't look good because Kane was like already like out of the way. So
yeah, he kind of just drove
just
himself,
like, meh, like moved his hand and Undertaker just crashes and burns through the announce table. It looked really dumb. It looked
but he
like
looked
the
so
Undertaker
good doing it.
It just looked like he was throwing himself through a table. Yep. Like, I'm done with this match. I'm just going to jump through this table. So the match itself, I didn't think it was anything special. Like you guys said, the story, I think, is so cool. And I love to see more like stuff like that today in wrestling. And that's why people remember it, because it was such a really cool story. But I will credit them for this, is that the finisher fest, they only did this in one match in the entire show. And I think that's really cool that I felt like in this show, this is the perfect time to bring up that finishers really meant something. Like,
they did.
Pretty much every match was like one finisher, it's done. And they saved the whole finisher kickout fest for this match. So Kane really does seem like this ultimate monster, this beast, because he's kicking out of two tombstone pile drivers when everyone else is like, one finisher, it's over. Kane's kicking out of two tombstones, which is insane. So I think that was a great way to make Kane look super strong, and they didn't overdo it in the show. So props to them for that. That's really like the high mark of the match for me.
And the presentation itself was actually really good, because even though we didn't really talk about the stage, you know, when you think about WrestleMania to this day, we've gone to multiple together, as a matter of fact, you know, it's a spectacle. Like, even the match aside, it's, you know, what does the stage look like? Here, it's a circle. It is a circle, and people come out of it. But this was the first
match. They weren't quite the company and had the funds to do all that crazy crap yet. So
yeah. But with here, you had the Druids coming out with The Undertaker. You had the theme song. It felt like a big deal. And even if the match didn't necessarily deliver, you felt like, okay, here we go. We're getting to the deep matches. Like, this is what WrestleMania is all about. Earlier into the match, I thought Kane almost killed The Undertaker, because they did like this electric chair drop, which for those who don't know, it's like when you lift the guy over your shoulders, like his legs are, you know, between your shoulders, you lift him up and you pancake him down like face first. And that looked really nasty. Like that could have been a really bad spot, but I enjoyed it for what it was, but I've never been a fan of big man matches. And I think you guys can agree, you know, this is the complete contrast to the light heavyweight championship match. If that one was too fast, this one is a little, this is too slow and no substance to it in the mm-hmm. match standpoint. Maybe there's a story, but I think there's very
you
little story
being
told.
You didn't feel it in the match as much.
Exactly.
No, not at all.
Like the bell rings, all that matters is who wins and loses. There was very little. It wasn't your Shawn Michaels versus The Undertaker. It wasn't Triple H versus The Undertaker. It wasn't Triple H and Shawn Michaels versus Kane and The Undertaker.
It wasn't.
Well,
yeah. Any comment?
Then again, what can be?
Yeah. That's true. And you know, for the most part, the Observer agreed with our opinion to this match, only giving it 1.5 stars.
So what we're saying is Sable is a better wrestler than Undertaker or Kane?
Confirmed.
Confirmed.
Yeah. Hey, Dave Meltzer pointed it out. That's not us, people. And now we have and now we have ourselves the main event, ladies and gentlemen, for the WWF World Heavyweight Championship. Stone Cold Steve Austin, Shawn Michaels, Iron Mike Tyson is a special guest enforcer. Super, you know, like the previous match, super going all out with the entrances. I always love, like with this era, I always called it the Hell in a Cell or the Bret Hart thing, where they have the dun 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 as they're getting ready to walk out. They show the guys and they play the theme song. Just little details letting you know this is it. This is the match you care about. And before that, you know, you even have Shawn Michaels making a quote to the camera, like, this is for the Montreal Screwjob, or this is for you, Earl. Just like, I get it. I get it. You're talking about them screwjobs.
Well, no, actually, because Earl Hebner was in the hospital that night.
Oh,
okay. He got rushed to the hospital like the night before. So he was saying, like, this is for you, Earl.
Oh, that's
so different.
Because
you couldn't be there to commentate the match.
That's so different.
Well, the more you know.
This is why you're the wrestling guy.
Keith is the wrestling fact. See, like, out of context, I assume the same thing, Juan, because I didn't know that little fact. So it's a good thing to point out.
I'm so sad now.
Yeah.
It's like, you take that back.
I'm sorry, guys.
Poor Earl Hebner.
I didn't know. I'm not selling t-shirts illegally on the outside of the company building.
Oh, you got him. Got him.
So, Shawn Michaels, he's also traded to, as I mentioned earlier, with Triple H, the DX entrance with the theme song, which I almost got a seizure. I forgot
cuts. Seriously. I was thinking the same thing. I'm like, holy crap. They need to do like a warning before that entrance.
Yeah.
Seriously. Like, I think they've chilled out in recent years with the DX entrance. They know not to be like cutting like back and forth so much. Like, it was so hard to tell what the hell was going on.
I have a theory, because in Triple H's later theme songs, once he got his push, it says, "Yo, done, keep that finger off the switch." I feel like they're talking about this.
Really?
Match.
Yeah.
Just for how many cuts there were to, like, oh, the X, and then here's the wall falling down. Like, oh my God, just keep a shot for more than 2 seconds here.
You say that now. I would love to get a shot of the production truck as that was happening. Just somebody going, okay, I'm just cutting to this. I'm just cutting to this. Come on. I'm making this entrance epic. Why are so many people dying and falling on the floor now? I'm so sorry. But we're getting to Shawn Michaels versus Stone Cold Steve Austin. This is interesting because, as you pointed out, Keith, both guys are technically injured and going into this match. They're definitely not 100%, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I mentioned, Shawn Michaels had a back injury during a match with The Undertaker at Royal Rumble of January of that year. And yeah, he was basically, it was... just get Shawn to this match. Do what we need to do so Shawn can get in that ring and wrestle Stone Cold Steve Austin. And then you had Austin, who broke his neck at SummerSlam because of a botched pile driver to Owen Hart. Like, these are guys that were nowhere near 100% in that match. But at the end of the day, I don't really think it mattered, because match quality aside, more than most things since then, this match had an insane big fight feel to it. Just, you felt like history was happening there. You can go back and realize just how important that match was, and it delivered on that front.
So, before we talk about the match, I got to talk about Mike Tyson. Did nobody teach him how to do crotch chops?
Yeah, I was going
to
say the same thing. Like that.
It's so awkward. He's like struggling. Okay, so you put the two hands together, two arms. Am I supposed to fly? Am I supposed to fly away? Like, what is this? It was so bad. Like, you're supposed to be the baddest man on the planet. Poor guy.
He's like, you have to make the X, but you can never move it. Like, you can never move the arms. It just has to, they have to stay locked. Like,
so bad. Somebody make a gift for Ryan doing that now, please. So Keith, I feel like you're ready to talk about the match, right?
Yeah, it was a great match for what it was. You know, Mike Tyson crotch chop aside, like I mentioned, it was exactly what it needed to be. It's not this like catch as catch can classic, as JR likes to say. The point of that match was to go out there and crown Stone Cold Steve Austin as the new WWF champion. It was a passing of the guard. And that's exactly what happened there. Shawn Michaels is one of the best wrestlers ever, period. You can't argue that. And even in his limited state, Shawn Michaels still went out there and had an amazing match. And looking at speculation, there was apparently rumors that Michaels wasn't going to go out there and put Austin over to the degree where the Undertaker had to talk to him and be like, you need to do this. This is what's best for business. And went out there and did it. And, you know, it fired on all cylinders on that account. You had your stunner. Stone Cold Steve Austin won. You have the famous shot of JR going, the Austin era has begun.
Stone Cold.
Mike Tyson came, had the fastest count in the history of wrestling, was very excited. You know, he just had the speed of those crotch chops leading to that 1-2-3. And boom, we have a new champion. We have a new era. It was the last match that you've ever seen of Shawn Michaels. I guess not that you've ever seen, because he came back.
I went a little too deep there.
And just a great purpose overall. I got very dramatic there, over dramatic.
Nobody ever saw Shawn Michaels again.
He just never seen it again. To the sunset.
He's a myth.
Oh, God.
Some say he disappeared into the Austin 316 t-shirt.
It's been a long day. I'm sorry.
Oh, man. No, but
yeah, so we wouldn't see him until like 4 or 5 years later, something like that. But for me, it's like when you look at it now, this match was about the destination and not the journey. Because it seemed, for a WrestleMania main event, it felt short. It didn't feel like this epic clash. It just kind of felt like a normal match, and it was like, boom, one stunner, done. Which, I can appreciate that they didn't have to go to the whole finisher fest and you want to solidify the stunner. But it just kind of felt like, it was a match. Like, it felt like a, you know, 2-2.5 star match. Like, I thought it was fine.
Well, would you like to know what it actually got?
Let's see how close I was.
It is, according to Dave Meltzer and the Wrestling Observer, it is a 3.25 star match.
Really?
Oh, it's pretty high.
Okay.
I honestly think that it's more about the feel of the match and the environment and how, like, the fact it felt like such a big fight.
I feel like he gave a bonus star just for being the Mania main event.
Maybe. Which, for the Mania main event, we saw a lot of male behind. Because earlier in the match, first
like
the Shawn
Michaels
Mike Tyson
thing. Almost just ripped Austin's tights right off his body. Yeah.
That's when the real Austin era began. Dude, seriously, he ripped that so hard. It's just insane.
But Michaels drilled Triple H on the way out when he like flipped over. You know, when he flipped over the ropes, yeah. His legs like really came down on him.
He could have easily broken his neck or something with that fall, but that goes to show just how great Michaels is. I remember one of my favorite moments in this match, such a simple thing, Stone Cold clothesline Shawn Michaels as he was on the side, and he landed on the announcer table. It wasn't like a huge spot. Technically, it was pretty easy because all he did was fall to the table. He didn't break it or anything, but it looked vicious. It looked rough, and I think that even though Shawn Michaels was injured, it reminded you the art of selling in a wrestling match, the art of making it look like something hurts without really overdoing it. And I mean, he made Austin look like a Stone Cold killer, you know, no pun intended, because it just made him look like a star, and it makes sense. I don't know how aware WWE was at the time, you know, that Shawn Michaels would never be seen again. But hey, if he was never seen again, at least he made Stone Cold look pretty darn good. What do you guys think about the closing of the match? As you mentioned, super quick three count by Iron Mike Tyson. And I thought that it was interesting how everything just sort of flowed afterwards. It was like, hey, we were all in on this. What did you think, Keith, especially when going back to this?
I found it to be very good symbolism of the passing of the guard. Like, Mike Tyson was almost like the guard incarnate, where, okay, we switched from the D-Generation X era into the Stone Cold Steve Austin era. The Austin era has begun. And looking back, especially, you could see that that's the exact moment where everything changed. And I think they did a really good job with it. Apparently, Shawn Michaels wasn't cool with the laying the Austin shirt over him. Had a lot of problems with that, but I think it was great symbolism for what they were going for.
Yeah, no, I mean, it worked. And at the end of the day, Austin's supposed to be your guy. So having Mike Tyson endorse Austin, you know, you're the real Shawn Michaels now, Austin, or whatever that Roman line meme was. But I appreciated that. Yeah, Juan's just, what was the actual line?
You tried. I don't know.
Yeah, whatever. So yeah, you have Mike Tyson endorsing Austin, a badass in boxing who's super relevant in that time, basically being like, yeah, this guy's the man. And that just helped elevate Austin even more. I mean, everyone was already on board for Austin, and that just, like, you know, helped even further.
One of my biggest regrets is that, because I never saw this back in the day, it seems obvious now that, oh yeah, he turned on Shawn Michaels because we know about it, right? So we don't watch this waiting to be surprised. But when you look at the steps, even though he can do the crotch chops, which maybe, and this is just me thinking, he can do them because he was never supporting DX to begin with. So he was forcing himself to do that.
Some meta theories there.
I use the thing called the brain every now and then. No, but it's like, think of all the media press. You know, you go back to the opening video package of this match. They're selling this like, this isn't a wrestling match. This is an entertainment spectacle, because you have Mike Tyson. You have, you know, the end all be all of entertainment right now, showcased into one event, into the main event. And then at the end, as you guys mentioned, passing of the torch. Oh, psych, it's not Shawn Michaels, it's Stone Cold. And then we know everything that happens afterwards. Unfortunately, because of the injury that Keith mentioned with Stone Cold with the Tombstone, he was never quite the same. You know, his wrestling style had to change dramatically. We know his career really was not extended that long. Like, Stone Cold technically retired later in like 2003, but he was never the same guy. You know, they got some more mileage out of him, but who knows what Stone Cold could have really been had he not had that injury, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Totally, it's crazy to think about.
Yeah, a totally different path could have been taken.
Because you don't realize it because of how much of Austin's career like happened post-injury and all of the great moments. But if you look at Stone Cold Steve Austin's wrestling matches before that incident, like, he was an incredible wrestler. Like, some of that stuff with Bret Hart still holds up today. It's amazing. And it's so unfortunate that Austin was limited because of that injury, because he really could have been like the best character ever and the best wrestler ever.
Yeah, definitely, man. What would you say, I'm not going to say match, it can be a match. What was your favorite thing about the show? Can be anything in particular, because I think that as we've talked, maybe the wrestling portion was a little meh.
I would say two things. The dumpster match was probably my favorite match of the show, and Pete Rose was my favorite moment of the show. That whole it just doesn't get old, that entire Pete Rose bit, and then Kane coming out and tombstoning him.
I would probably say the best things were just the crowd reactions for Sable and Austin, because you don't hear crowd reactions like that anymore. Just like
true.
That universal just roar of the crowd when just like, you know, like 99.9% of that crowd is just all in on these people. And I do miss that just hardcore dedication and just crazy crowd reactions.
That was actually one of my favorite things as well, because I think that with the exception of the light heavyweight championship match, which people really didn't care about, you could feel the excitement that that crowd had. And it was even for regular matches, you know, like what you mentioned, the whole Sable thing. You talk about the women's movement and the evolution of women. Of course, like Sable was a very sexualized character. I mean, from Playboy to everything she did, but people cared about her. I mean, she was a huge deal. And before that, we had Sunny. So what was my favorite thing about this was witnessing the evolution like that. The Rock interview. Yeah, it was cringy, but it was fascinating to watch because you know what's going to happen. I mean, you know who The Rock is in 2018. The fact that The Rock is probably most relevant in 2018 than he's ever been before. And this happened. Hey, and this show cringy, happened in 98.
As cringy as that interview was, that's still so much more charisma than you see in a lot of interviews today.
True.
And like, you know what? It's character. It's cringy, but it's charisma and it's character. And that's something that's deeply missed in a lot of ways.
And those interviews are my favorite thing about wrestling, and they practically don't exist anymore. Whether they're good or bad, as you tell me, like they're developing somebody. That person, whether you agree with them or not, they're showing you not the ropes, you know, not the person between the ropes. They're showing you the human being or the character behind the wrestling matches.
You get to see Dwayne Johnson as a hung jury.
How many stars would Dave Meltzer give? Does the show hold up? Does the show hold up in your eyes? Would you recommend somebody that maybe hasn't seen this to actually go back and relive WrestleMania 14 or for the first time?
Does it hold up? Yes. I think it's a fascinating piece to see where the Attitude Era began. I think it's a one-moment show in the way that it's the main event is the entire show. And for that reason, I honestly don't know if I would recommend it unless you want to go deep into wrestling history and you're curious where everything began. If you just want to look at this show on its own, I find it hard to recommend.
Yeah, I would say, like, historically, there's a few things that are pretty relevant to the history of wrestling, but does it hold up as an actual wrestling show? No, I don't think so. It's really kind of run-of-the-mill, not very great. So I would say just on terms of just a wrestling show, it does not hold up.
I'll summarize by saying this. I think that 97 through like 99 would make a great trailer. But I think that if you sit down and watch the actual movie, in this case, like WrestleMania 14 as an event, there's no way I can recommend somebody sit down and watch this 2 hour, 44 minute thing when there's arguably like a good 10, 20 minutes, and I'm stretching that, I'll be honest, of entertainment, of really, really good stuff in that show. There's other WrestleManias that are top to bottom awesome. Are all of them like that? Hell no. We've been at some of the live WrestleManias that have been lackluster, or we've watched some that went like, what in the blue hell is this supposed to be? But WrestleMania 14, I'd say watch some clips. You know, there's enough documentaries, there's enough DVDs, or go into the network and check out the main event match. Maybe check out, you know, the Intercontinental title match because it's hilarious and you get to witness The Rock try to basically murder Ken Shamrock with a steel chair. So that's something. But aside from that, how do you feel this compares to modern day wrestling? You know, we don't really watch wrestling day to day now. I mean, Keith does, you know, he has a wrestling podcast called The Six Pack Challenge. Do you feel like us that have consumed wrestling in the last 5 years, is it fascinating to see the evolution? Like, can you pinpoint and figure out, hey, this is different now, this is different now? Do you appreciate that when going back?
I find it incredibly fascinating because everything is just so more like methodical now and more produced, where everything was just kind of, everything felt seat of its pants in this event, especially with matches like the Battle Royal, where it was just a cluster of a match, where that just wouldn't happen these days because everything is so overly produced that you wouldn't have a situation where somebody leaves the ring and the other team member just doesn't know that that's actually happened and he's still trying to win the match. You just don't get that anymore. And it's fascinating. Is it better? Well, that could be argued, but it's fascinating at least.
Yeah, it's quite surprising how much better quality of matches has gotten compared to this event. But I feel like there's definitely like the middle ground was kind of lost, whereas this is kind of just like a lot of, it feels like a lot of the times they're just winging it. Like, I mean, you watch today's wrestling and it's like everything, it's like every big spot is done perfectly in the center of the ring and they are facing the main camera so that you get the best shot of it. So it feels overproduced, as Keith said, where it doesn't feel like this is a brawl right now. It feels like, oh, gotta smile for the camera and hit my finisher directly in the center of the ring, because that's what you're supposed to do. Because I mean, you look at like certain shots and it's like they're like their back is to the camera because, you know, they're just doing whatever they want. So there is kind of that like raw element to it that's missing from today. So I feel like there's that middle ground somewhere that would be like a nice mix of the two. So there's definitely a lot of things I appreciate about just kind of the raw elements. I mean, no pun intended with wrestling at that time. I mean, I find it hilarious, even things like small things like with the stretchers, where they brought people, like put people on a stretcher. They were just kind of like, blip, I'm going to put you on the stretcher. Yep. There was no like, oh, he can't move his neck, he can't move his neck, we got to get him on.
Somebody
no,
put up like, the X.
They just kind of like shuffled you onto a stretcher. You know, it was like two interns just like came out and threw you on a stretcher who had no qualifications for handling someone who was injured. So that stuff was kind of funny, but it did feel a little more authentic in some ways.
I think that's part of the reason that I love going back with some old school wrestling. I think that as time has gone by, people talk about like the 2000s to like 2004s in a negative light, but I think that was like a really solid middle ground that I think eventually we should maybe look back at, because when looking at this, the comparison, as you mentioned, Ryan, the match quality, I mean, it's insane the difference, but I think like it goes to show the storytelling is so difficult in a wrestling match, because the fact of the matter is that this didn't feel like a WrestleMania to me. This felt like Raw, like a SmackDown, like the in-between pay-per-view. Like, why is this supposed to be any special or more special than the other ones? And I think that WrestleMania sort of, much like the Undertaker streak, you know, it kind of started, but then it just became like a regular show. You know, in hindsight, the Undertaker streak was a big deal, but they didn't make a big deal out of it till like, you know, mid-2000s, really.
Yeah, they didn't even mention, like, in this show that he was undefeated, even though it was, what, his, like, seventh WrestleMania or eighth WrestleMania?
It wasn't until many years after.
Yeah, he was, like, 6 or 7-0 at that point, and no mention of that.
So, do you think that this show, as a closing comment, looking at the legacy of WrestleMania, the legacy of WWF, of all the people involved, is there anything that you think, like, this is what WrestleMania 14 brought to the wrestling world? This is what it left, or it laid the foundation for things that happened afterwards?
I mean, Jim Ross probably said it best. The Austin era has begun. I would say that this match is the beginning of what we know as the Attitude Era. This show, thank you. That, and even that Stone Cold Steve Austin match is the beginning of what we know as the Attitude Era. And that's this show's legacy, where that is the beginning between that period, the end of that match and the end of WrestleMania 17, that is what we know as the most influential time period in wrestling history. And we wouldn't have had that if we didn't have WrestleMania 14.
Yeah, at the end of the day, the way I feel like wrestling works is, especially these big events, they always get boiled down to a couple of highlights. And at the end of the day, WrestleMania 14 just comes down to that the Austin era has begun highlight. And you also have the Undertaker Kane like stare down. They don't usually show the match. They just show the stare down.
Gee, I wonder
why.
So
it's like really what dictates the what a WrestleMania is when the next WrestleMania season's coming up, what highlights you see from the old WrestleManias, that is its legacy. And those two highlights are what we know of WrestleMania 14. It solidified Stone Cold Steve Austin as a main event guy, and that's the most important part.
Definitely. And I'm very happy that we had a chance to not just talk about the show, but rewatch it. Or in my case, I really think this was the first time I had ever watched it complete. I mean, I think that if you're a wrestling fan, naturally, you're going to see all these clips like Ryan mentioned. But watching it, we're not recommending people go back. But I'm happy that I watched it because it's...
We did it for you.
Exactly. We went through the pain, so you didn't have to go through it. But we will be doing some wrestling stuff every now and then. We come from a wrestling fan background. That is what originally spawned our passion, our love for podcasting. So if you guys and gals want us to do any more wrestling stuff down the line, let us know and maybe suggest other stuff. Keith was the person that really suggested this one because it is, hypothetically or maybe factually, the beginning, the dawn of the Attitude Era. So if there's any other landmark, you know, any historical piece of wrestling that you're like, guys, just sit down, watch this, talk about it. It can be a Raw. It can be any particular thing about wrestling. The network, luckily, makes it very, very accessible. So let us know. But my friends, I'm very excited for this because we're going to remind you of a couple of the upcoming episodes. And stay tuned, because with that last one, we're not going to decide the episode. You guys are. So, Keith.
That is right.
What's going on?
So, come December 2nd, our next big episode, we're going to be taking a little trip. Where, you ask? Well, we're going to Liberty City and checking out Grand Theft Auto 3. This was basically the father of open world GTA style games. It's what WrestleMania 14 was to the Attitude Era, to open world games. I think I said that right.
Nice.
Anyway, we're going to be checking out GTA 3. I've been playing it already. I'm having a ton of fun with it. Can't wait to talk about it. Then moving on to December 16th, our holiday special, we're going to be checking out the first Home Alone movie. I have memories of Home Alone 2. I don't exactly remember the first Home Alone, so I'm looking forward to checking this out.
Hashtag
and really breaking
neglect.
It down. Yeah, no kidding. We should just do like a side thing of how many CFS laws this movie breaks. But we'll get there December 16th. And moving on, like Juan mentioned, to the end of the year, December 30th, we couldn't decide what we wanted to do, so we need you to help us. We're going to be putting up a poll at a later date, and you're going to decide between three movies for us. What are those movies, you may be asking? Well, here's your answer. It's going to be either Mortal Kombat,
the first one.
The original. We'll get to Annihilation some other time. Super Mario Bros. The movie.
Ugh.
And finally, Air Bud.
Okay, let's be clear. Who recommended which movie, Keith?
All right. I'm pretty sure I recommended Mortal Kombat. That was a couple hours ago. I don't remember at this point. Juan, you were Super Mario Brothers?
Yes.
And then Ryan, you burned us with Air Bud, baby. So we'll be putting out
a clever tagline for this one. Because there was a football one later that was like Golden Receiver or whatever.
Oh my God.
Oh.
But no, this is the first one. This is the basketball Air Bud movie, mm-hmm. The first.
And we'll be putting up that poll very soon. Stay tuned to our social media account at @acasttothepast. And you decide what we're going to watch come December 30th.
Decide our fate.
Yeah, we're going to be putting up that poll on Twitter because Facebook will not let us put three different options. So that's going to be going on Twitter.
Bastards.
We'll make sure to spread that love all the way out there. You can also chat with us on social media, on Discord, at castofthepast.com/Discord. And I don't know if you can tell, but there's a recurring theme with all three movies in that. I mean, Air Bud is relative, but they're not exactly great movies. Although, because I know Keith, you're going to say that, this first Mortal Kombat movie, not nearly as bad as Annihilation.
It's a solid all right.
Yeah. It's a solid D minus compared to the Annihilation's F. So we'll be talking about that based on your recommendations. Remember, I chose Super Mario Brothers. Keith chose Mortal Kombat. Ryan chose Air Bud.
Air Bud.
Says a lot about Ryan.
Air
Which
Bud.
Team are you in?
Air so, Bud.
Oh my God. I really hope it's not. How does that episode even get shaped up? Do you talk about golden retrievers first? Like, is that the context? Hey, which other dogs came out that year?
Let's talk about dog breeds in 1999.
It was
or
a
whatever
big year for the Shih Tzu.
Oh my God.
This movie was the Shih Tzu. Yeah.
So with that being said, folks, thank you for watching. If you haven't subscribed to the YouTube channel, castofthepast.com/YouTube, leave us a review on iTunes or any of the podcast apps. Subscribe to all of the above. Whether you're watching us on YouTube, you can send us an email to acastofthepast@gmail.com. Suggest the agenda for the year, as you can tell, has been booked. We have some cool ideas for the beginning of the year. Keith, above everybody, is super excited because we got some awesome games, some awesome movies, but we're always saving some spots for all of you. So take care, have an awesome time, and up until next time, this has been another episode of A Cast
to the
Past.
It was better.
That was better this time.
We're getting there.
We'll get there.
Yeah, exactly. So take care, everybody.